The following programming is sponsored by Clean and Sober Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
If you need immediate help, please call the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP.
Bottle of wine, fruit of the vine. When you gonna let me get sober? Let me go home and start over.
Welcome to Clean and Sober Radio. Brought to you in part by Jefferson University Hospitals and Thomas Jefferson University, providing excellent clinical and compassionate care in the Philadelphia region, a proven leader in healthcare and education since 1825, and Acadia Healthcare, with locations on the East Coast. Acadia maintains a standard for excellence in the treatment of behavioral health and addiction concerns. And now, here are your hosts, Gary Hendler and Mark Sigmund.
Hey, thanks for joining us, and welcome to the show once again. Clean and Sober Radio features real people with real stories about addiction to drugs and alcohol. Mark, what's new in recovery news this week?
So a semi-submersible vessel carrying an estimated 1,000 packages of cocaine was intercepted in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Colombia, the country's Navy announced. The news comes after another narco sub was seized carrying two bodies and a huge haul of drugs found in the same region recently. The cocaine was worth an estimated $33 million and headed to Central America.
Ooh.
I know.
How would you like to be the guy supplying that and find out he lost all that?
It's crazy. And it's crazy to think they have these little submarines that they pack with drugs. Yeah. And go in the Pacific Ocean. Imagine being those narcos that are driving the submarine underneath the ocean. I mean, that would be crazy.
Is that how they? I guess the submarines catch them. Is that what it
is? I don't know. And so pretty disturbing. But they're using these submarines to get, I don't know where they dock, but to get the drugs across the ocean, probably to the United States.
Man, that is crazy, so,
isn't it?
Yeah. What else you got there?
So a new NIH study reveals that shared genetic markers underlying substance use disorders. Breakthrough findings could lead to more effective treatment interventions. The researchers combed through genomic data of over 1 million people. Scientists identified specific genes commonly inherited across addiction disorders regardless of drug of choice. The genes were associated with regulation of the dopamine signaling. Now, this is interesting because we talk about the disease concept and we've always said there's this genetic backing, but people couldn't really place what it was. Yeah. This was a huge study, 1 million people, and finding these common genetic markers across these people for all different drugs.
Well, you know, it's hard to even comprehend what you just said, but you know, it's all good. The more information we have about this disease, I think the better it will be with someday maybe we can get it under control.
Yeah, and the more that they figure out what genes they are in the future, the better they're going to be able to treat this thing.
Absolutely.
So it's interesting stuff.
It is interesting stuff. Thank you very much. Hey, listen, when we come back, our guest is Ricky Byrd. Ricky Byrd spent 10 years with Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. He is a rock and roll guitar player, singer, songwriter, producer. He's played with the most famous people. And that's one part of his life. And then he got into he's in long-term recovery. We're glad he's going to be with us as soon as we come back. And we're going to find out what it is like to be a true rock and roll star. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF-NOW. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
Hey, man, this is Ricky Byrd, former member of Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, an inductee to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as of 2015. And I listen to Clean and Sober Radio, and so do my friends here, right?
888-728-9941. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Clean and Sober can also be heard on these radio stations, WGAC in Augusta, Georgia, WHFS, Tampa, Florida, and WWWE 1100 in Atlanta, Georgia.
Going across the country.
Across the country. And now, Ricky Bird, welcome to the show once again, brother.
How you doing, Gary?
Good. How are you?
Oh, I'm okay.
What's the matter, Ricky? What's the matter? What are you eating?
Candy bar.
I was drinking some water.
Okay, that's okay.
He drinks a lot of water.
It's the noise the plastic bottle makes.
Yeah. Is that what it is? Well, yeah. That's good. You drink a lot of water, man.
I'm sitting in my home studio, and I'm looking at all these songs. See, I have a show April 8th, an acoustic show.
Where?
Solo show in Torrington, Connecticut, at a really beautiful theater called the Warner.
Okay.
And I haven't done it in so long. Obviously, not since the pandemic. I used to play acoustic all the time, but I need an hour and 15 worth of material. So every night, it's all about repetition and it's about discipline. Yeah. So I come down here into the studio and I pick it songs. I figure I need about, I don't know, 14, maybe 15 for an hour and 15.
Uh-huh.
Except I like to talk, so I probably talk in between songs, so it's probably
right.
Like seven.
Right.
And I'm just looking at the lyrics here and figuring out which songs I'm going to do. I have like three solo albums, and now I'm putting out, excuse me, I'm putting out singles on Wicked Cool Records, which is Little Steven's label. So
man, that's fantastic. I'll
do a few from here, a few from there, and then a couple of maybe cover songs that are like favorites of mine. But, you know, there's a lot of it. I won't lie. It's a little stressful because I haven't done it in so long. So in my mind, I'm telling myself, you know, you can't do this. And of course I can.
Yeah, that's the stuff that goes on in our head. Even a guy like you and people, you know, look, Rick, you're a rock and roll star, a real one, you know, a real, real, real guy who's been very successful. And even you get nervous. Even you have anxiety. And I guess that's why all of us turned to drugs when we couldn't handle anything else back then, you know?
There's an interesting – I've been watching Godfather of Harlem is like my favorite show right now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know – are you familiar with that?
I've heard it. I have not seen it.
Me neither.
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's the story of Bumpy Johnson, who was the godfather of Harlem.
Thanks,
he worked. He worked with Lucky Luciano back in the 20s, you know, and one of the first people that brought heroin, or as they call it, doogie, to America, and sold it up in Harlem. And he goes to prison. He comes out 11 years later, and that's where the story starts. So he's working with, you know, Vincent Gigante and Joe Colombo and stuff like that, and Joe Bonanno. It's such a great show. Forrest Whitaker plays Bumpy Johnson. Vincent D'Onofrio plays Gigante. Chaz Palminteri plays
one of my favorites,
Joe Bonanno. And now Joe Colombo's in it, and he's having a conversation with Joe Colombo. It just struck me when he was sitting there, and Johnson's been through. Like every time he seems like he's getting on his feet again, something happens. So in the last few episodes, the Harlem riots, the civil rights riots, the day that they passed the civil rights bill, well, Lyndon Johnson passed it. So there happened to be a riot. A police officer killed an unarmed black boy, mm-hmm. and Harlem was on fire. And I remember it. I mean, I'm old enough. I was a little kid, but I remember the whole thing and completely burnt down stores and, you know, schools and everything. There's a thing going on. So there was a giant payload of heroin that came in, and Bumpy Johnson was, you know, he was going to own everything. He's going to be the central distributor in Harlem. And it gets burnt down. The factory where they were keeping it gets burnt down in this civil rights thing, which is ironic, no? But what got me was he was sitting with Joe Colombo. They're having a conversation. I'm paraphrasing. And I think it was with Colombo. But he's explaining how, you know, all the stuff he's been through since he's been in prison and does this and that. And he says, the world of Joe Colombo, whoever he's talking to, let's say Colombo, says, yeah, the world is a screwed up place. And Bumpy Johnson says, Forrest Whitaker says, why do you think everybody gets high?
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I went, wow, yeah, that's interesting.
It's called escapism, right?
Yeah.
It is, you know. So, Ricky.
It's a wide statement, but, you know, for a lot of people it's true because it's difficult as it is in your own life to be have coping mechanisms, correct?
Yes.
You know, to deal with the stuff in your own life, and then you look around and see what's going on in the world. And, dude, this show takes place in the 60s, and, like, we're going through crap now again. It never ends.
It never ends.
So, you know, for a lot of people, that's probably one of the reasons why they use is to not deal. That's my opening statement.
That's a good opening statement because it's apropos to everybody that's in this room almost, except for Brad, and the rest of the world. I mean, can you remember, Ricky, growing up, the things either how you felt you looked or how you felt you spoke that made you feel insecure and you wanted to get out of that? I can certainly remember for me.
Yeah, so here's the deal. And I'm only speaking for me. And it actually, it's to what you were talking about when you started a few minutes ago. So, you know, I grew up in the Bronx. I don't live in the Bronx anymore, but I was born in the Bronx. I lived there until I was like 13. And I was very shy and quiet when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I guess I felt insecure. I mean, I felt, I don't know what the word is. I was just off on my own a lot. I like to read. I escaped in books. I still love to read. You know, I always got a book I'm starting. I think when we were all about the age of 13, and it varies, that's the time when kids start experimenting. And back in my time when I was that age, it was, you know, pot was the major thing. Yeah, I guess. I guess I smoked my first joint at 13, and I felt this, whatever was bothering me,
yeah.
The joint took it away.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, so, you know, there's a million reasons why people use, whether it's alcohol or drugs or sex or gambling. It's to get out of yourself, right?
That's what
it is. But for me, you know, what you were talking about before is like I have it in my family. My dad was an alcoholic, and so was his father. And I have, you know, somebody who's been an uncle who's been clean over 40 years. So on that side of my family, there is that gene. So what happened? I smoked that first joint, and I noticed that everything seemed a little bit brighter, lighter, and I felt better. But a lot of people felt that way, and a lot of people did it for a while and then grew up. The gene part of it is the thing that once you have the first one, it sets off like this pinball machine in your head.
That's exactly right.
And you want more. So there's compulsion and obsession and craving, I guess, when you get into other stuff.
That gene, I always bring up when we talk about the gene part of this, of addiction. We have, my best friend was a kid named David Sussman. He's an identical twin to his brother, Steven. Steven's probably watching right now. And David became a heroin addict. Later, he cleaned himself up. And his brother never touched anything. And is a professor, PhD professor at a university in Florida. How does that happen?
That's an anomaly a little bit. Because what you see with these gene studies is normally both will develop this. Maybe it was an environmental thing, you know, because you need, you get both. You get the environment and the genetics, and maybe his brother didn't go through the trauma that possibly David went through.
It's a combination of life experiences and a gene that you might be carrying. And then you got the person that says, well, there's nobody in my family has an addictive mm-hmm. personality. Well, it's got to start somewhere, no?
Yeah, you dig deep enough, you're going to find it.
Yeah,
or not.
Right.
You know, maybe not, but it's got to start somewhere.
It does.
And we're listening to Ricky Burr.
The other thing is, and I'm not an expert on anything. You know, I'm just a guy that found recovery. But there's all these new theories and there's all these new ways to get clean and stay clean and this and that. You know, I walked into a community support group meeting 35 and a half years ago, and that was the end. After 18 years of using.
Yeah.
So, like, it's different for everybody. Like, I found solace and companionship and camaraderie and sort of the same story, different people in a community support group meeting and the stuff that goes along with it. And I still go to those places. I try to go 3 times a week if I'm not insanely busy, but I'm always talking to people that are in recovery. So for me, that works. I guess they say it doesn't work for everybody, so that's why there's all these other things. But I know tons and tons of people in my almost 36 years of recovery that have over 30 years of that by doing that. So, you know,
That's
the point
right.
being is I'm trying to make a point is like whatever gets you keeps you on the right side of the grass is fantastic. Just don't bash 12-step meetings because it works for a lot of people.
Well, we agree with you. You know, I always say there's not one way to skin this cat, and but there are basics like don't pick up, and I think one of the basics is going to 12-step meetings, at least at the beginning. And I was going to meetings, Ricky, on a regular basis until I was probably sober for 35 years. And it's a good way to go.
It is. And, you know, I'll tell you, as a therapist, you know, I'll get people that are anti-meeting. And I try not to blur the water too much with, hey, try this other. I mean, sometimes you bring up some other things. But what I've seen is eventually when they do try, a lot of times if they're in a different stage, like they really want this thing, it works for them. You know, I mean, it's tried, true. It's worked for so many people. And, you know, it works for them. But sometimes you get people that, like, they're anti-meeting in the beginning, but once they feel enough pain, they start going, and then they see that it works.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I mean, to each his own. I would never besmirch. I don't think I ever used the word besmirch before. Is that a word?
No, I've never heard that word.
It's a good one, though.
Wait.
I'm going to have to go.
Besmirch?
I'm going to have to Google it. I think it's besmirch.
Sounds like out of the Smurfs or
it
something.
It sounds like out
doesn't
of a cartoon.
But I like it. I think it's a Ricky Birdism.
I would not put down any other method of staying clean. But I do remember if you're not ready to get clean and sober, you can find reasons to not go to meetings, find things that you don't like about it. There's that. And then there's people that don't like the higher power saying, that's understandable. But, you know, like, I'm not religious, period. You know, and whoever I pray to, I don't know what it is, and I'm not interested. Whatever it is, it's fabulous. I don't care. You know, when I do some of the work and stuff, and I reach out to something bigger than me, which sometimes is the meeting, I feel better. And why do I still go? I still go because – and I just went. I didn't go last night. I went the night before. It makes me – it could be force of habit, but it's also – it makes me better out in the real world, you know, or it attempts to. I'm not sure I am, but it calms my spirit down. And I don't know.
Don't need to know.
No, I don't need to know. And the other thing is, I do notice when I don't go for a couple of weeks or whatever, or talk to people. I mean, that's hard because I do a lot of stuff in recovery, so I'm always talking to somebody. But if I don't go and sit with other people in a room and hear the stories and the newcomer that just walked in that keeps it green for me, and I was like, oh, I'm not missing anything, am I? It keeps me on an even keel because it goes back to what we were saying before. Dude, if you watch enough news, you could throw yourself into the river, you know? I mean, just the daily news on TV is like, what the hell is going on?
Absolutely.
And it's easy to get depressed feelings when you're watching that stuff. And if you've already got depression issues, which I don't, you know, they could really throw you over the edge and make you feel like, well what's the point?
Yeah. Listen, if you're just joining us now, we're having a conversation with Ricky Bird, 10 years with Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. Ricky has played with everybody. He's in long-term recovery. And we're just we're having a good old chat like we usually do with our friend Ricky Bird. And if you want to give a call and speak with Ricky, our number is 1-888-728-9941. That is 1-888-728-9941. 9941. And you know what? You know, when we have – Mark, when we have a guest on like Ricky, you know, this is a really great opportunity to talk to him about his musical career and talk to him how he got into recovery. This is a good opportunity. And I know that Ricky would be glad to get some of these calls. Rick, so
yes.
Let's talk – you know, usually we're doing the show actually in reverse because usually we talk about where you came from, how you grew up. But since we're talking about your recovery, we can now, when we come back after a break in a little while, we can figure out how you got to where you got, if that makes any sense.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? We're not there yet. Yeah. We're not there yet.
I'll do the Reader's Digest version.
The Reader's Digest.
You got the Cliff Notes there with you, too?
Yeah, exactly.
You know. Let's see. All right. So what was your drug of choice, by the way?
More.
More. Yeah, yeah.
Can relate with that one, right?
I did have a relationship with cocaine. There's no doubt about that. So if I used for 18 years, you know, the first, I don't know, I'll say 10, maybe 9, we're sort of just fine, you know? I mean, yeah, did I get into trouble sometimes? Yeah, sure. But I was still very young, and I was just partying, like, you know, the people I hung out with. It's when I could certainly say everything changed when sort of my crowd started doing blow. Because I could never get enough, of course, because that's what the drug does. And that led to other stuff and mixing and matching. And then, you know, then you start circling the drain before long. I mean, it's not uncommon. The thing about the line is, the good thing about cocaine is it makes you feel like another man, but then 5 minutes later, the other man wants a hit.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think that maybe I'm just talking for myself now. I can use the same amount of years I did Quaalude, which was my drug of choice.
Yeah, we've had that conversation.
Yeah, we certainly have, Ricky.
I love that too. That was fabulous also. That was in the 70s, though.
That was in the 70s. That's correct. So, but, you know, and I thought I was okay. But you know what? I really wasn't okay. I mean, if I really had my wits about me and I could look around and see that everybody else was moving on with their lives and I was sitting there, you know, in the morning when the birds start chirping, I was sitting in the same chair that I was in 10 o'clock that night.
God, the sound of the garbage truck.
Yeah, I say the buses, but the garbage truck, same thing. Yeah.
What a horrible sound when you're still up.
Isn't it horrible? I know our audience can totally relate to this thing, you know?
Yeah, it gives me the chills now.
Yeah. Let's do this. Let's take a break. We come back. We're going to find a little bit about your background, Ricky, and we'll go from there. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Huntington Creek Recovery Center is Eastern Pennsylvania's premier provider of transformative care for individuals whose lives have been impacted by addiction. Our 40-acre campus offers a tranquil, recovery-focused environment. We specialize in evidence-based care that addresses the effects of trauma and offer a unique program specifically for adolescent males. Huntington Creek Recovery Center can help you achieve lasting sobriety. Call us today at 844-948-2320.
Hey, everybody, this is former Philadelphia Flyer Chris Terrien, and you're listening to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-728-9941. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Hey, if you're just joining us now, if you're just listening to us, you want to watch Mark and I actually do the show, you can watch us right now. Go to Facebook and go to our page, Clean and Sober Radio, like these folks. Laura Story, John Nichols, Kathy Wolf Collin, Todd Klotz, let's see who else is on here. Judge Christopher Maddox is watching. We always appreciate that. Laura Story, keep up the good work. Kelly Irwin Burchette is watching. These people are watching, and of course, I hope they're listening, but they are watching us. Let's see, we got so many people.
Ed McCash, he says a very interesting one. Getting clean was the second best thing I ever did. Working the steps was the first.
Good for him. Ruth Schaefer, Gary Gordon Goff, is watching us right now. Bob Mueller, hi guys. William Schiffman is watching. C. Ruger is watching. We got. Let's. Oh, I got one. I can't.
You can't forget.
I can't forget my daughter Sophie Handler's watching. Anyway, okay. all right, we're back with Ricky Bird. You know, Ricky, I'll tell you something. We're very fortunate that you come on this show because you're a big deal, man. And I respect, first of all, you know, I knew about your musical career. But, you know, the more that Mark and I talk to guys who are in your position in the music business or any other famous and they got into recovery, that's actually a better story.
And I always wonder how, you know, being a rock star, I'm sure everybody is throwing you drugs. And I always wondered, like, how did you do it, Ricky? I mean, it must have been really difficult because talk about people, places, and things, huh?
It had its moments. I got sober, like, you know, the first, well, for, you know, the deal was when you're in a rock and roll band. And that rock and roll star stuff is goofy. I'm a guitar player. You know, I've been in a band that had a number one record and stuff. You know, I got to play around the world, play big places and small places, and I still get to do all this cool stuff. I'm a working musician, you know. That's a media term. But the deal is you're in a band and you're putting records out. Because I was still with Joan, right, when I got clean. Mm-hmm. And you would tour a lot. You'd come home, you'd do a record, then you'd hit the road to tour the record, then you'd come home, do another record, then you'd go and tour the record. So it's a lot of that. And there was a lot of partying, you know, I'll only speak for myself, throughout that. And when I got home that, it was September 87, that's when I made the phone call, and that's when I was taken to my first 12-step community support group meeting. And I can't remember how long. I do have a diary from then, but I can't remember how long I was home for, but I guess I got a little bit of a foundation. And then I went and I hit the road again, right, with the band. So I had to change my daily plans, so to speak. So the way it used to work was you would play the gig. If you were staying in a hotel, you'd wind up at the bar, right? And there'd be people that were at the show that usually find you and at the bar. And yeah, people would want to get the musician's high, of course. And you would be drinking and drugging. And when the bar closed at the hotel, you'd go back up to somebody's room and continue and go to sleep at 7 o'clock in the morning or something. Or you would go on a tour bus and travel 700 miles to the next gig. And then, you know, you would be doing your partying on the tour bus. That was a horrible, there's nothing like, talk about garbage cans, garbage trucks. When you pull into the town after partying all night and you're still up and you have to somehow walk from the tour bus to the front desk to get your keys to go to your room. Oh my gosh. When you've been, you know, doing blow all night, that was quite a walk. The walk of shame. So when I finally, when I got into recovery, I would go on the road, and what I would do is when I'd get to my room, I would call Intergroup for whichever program I was doing, and I'd say, hey, I'm in town for 2 days. Is there a meeting nearby? I had a sponsor that I would talk to and stuff, and somebody would actually pick me up, a stranger, and take me to a meeting and something. So that changed my whole thing, right? Because I wasn't up all night. And with that came to the fact of, like, if I was in a town I'm going to say I've never been to, because if I was there before I got into recovery, I really didn't see much. I would go walking around town, you know, and go to bookstores and this and that. So everything had to change. And it was difficult. At the beginning, I was the only person that in the close contact that wasn't using something, the people that I hung out with. So, yeah, it was interesting.
Well, I imagine, mean, Ricky,
you,
after
to
you
tell
stopped
you the truth,
using,
I'd be on the bus. I'd be in my bunk with a freaking big book, you know?
Yeah, I'd imagine after you stopped using, you had a lot of time on your hands, didn't you?
You had a lot of time on your hands, yeah. And also, there's a thing that goes on, and it has nothing to do with the music business, but, you know, your friends, whether out of being protective or whatever, it's like people don't want to hang out with you, you know? You're the sober guy.
Of course.
What fun is that?
Of course.
You go through that thing, and then you don't care. You know, it may feel weird at the beginning, and then you don't really give a crap because you're waking up feeling differently, and you're starting to feel healthier. And I just made a habit of going into 12-step community support group meetings around the country, around the world. And that's really how I did it. So it was difficult at the beginning, and then you just fall into sort of a pattern, and it gets easier. And then it becomes part of your world.
I remember, you know, we were just talking about waking up, sitting around, and the whole world's moving in the morning, and we're sitting there. I specifically remember a visual that you put into my head about you would perform in front of 20 or 30,000 people, you know, all the crap that goes on with that, and then you would go back to your hotel room by yourself. And that transition, I have thought about that so many times.
Yeah,
the silence must have been deafening.
That,
huh?
The juxtaposition of that was very big. It was very loud. The silence was very loud.
Yeah.
And I got into a habit of keeping the TV on the minute I walked into a hotel room till when I left, even when I went to sleep. Just because of the weirdness of it. And then we go through all the other stuff that you do when you're using, staring out the people, thinking that you're going to get, you know, the FBI's outside.
Oh yeah. That's called paranoia.
Is that what that is?
That's right. So Ricky, all right, I want to run around here a little bit. So you've played with The Who, Roger Daltrey, Ian Hunter, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, Joe Walsh, Alex. Look, we don't even have enough time on the show. Smokey Robinson, The Beach Boys, Graham Nash, Bruce Springsteen. When you were up there specifically with Paul McCartney, because I've seen that picture, did you think in your head, is this for real?
No. I think about it when I look at it now, but back then I was in the moment.
Yeah.
And we were getting inducted into the Rock Hall. I mean, if I could clarify, I played and recorded and toured with Joan for 10 years.
Right.
I did a record with Roger Daltrey and did a radio tour with them across the country and did some TV like Letterman and Dennis Miller and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I toured with Ian Hunter from Mötley Crüe. I did a tour with him in Scandinavia and England. And I toured with Southside Johnny. I was in that band for like a year and a half. That was way later, early 2000s. And then, you know, the other names, except for McCartney and Joe Walsh and Ringo and stuff, that was the Rock Hall. That was the night of the Rock Hall.
Okay.
So, you know, I like to clarify that I recorded and toured with the people I just mentioned, and then I was blessed to share a stage with people. Why do I say share a stage? So I got into this thing where people would call me to do events. So I would be in the All-Star Band. And so it would be me, maybe Liberty DeVito from Billy Joel's band, maybe Will Lee from Letterman, the bass player, you know, Jeff Carlisi from 38 Special. And we would back up people at an event. So when you look at my resume, I've played with Brian Wilson. I've played with Sam Moore from Sam and Dave. I've played with Smokey Robinson, Mavis Staples, Alice Cooper. And most of those are sharing the stage for events I did. So I got to do like three songs with Smokey. I got to do three songs with Brian Wilson. You know what I mean? So it's just a clarification.
Well, that's fine. I mean,
the people that I actually toured with and I recorded with, as opposed to the people that I got to play with, you know, equally as important. And in fact, I like this part of my career as a musician better than the other part, because when you're in a band, you wind up doing the same songs every night. You may switch out a song here and there, but basically for years and years, you're doing the same songs. And you got to find the spark in each night. It's a different crowd, right? When you're doing these events, you're really being tested as a musician because it's all kinds of music.
Ricky,
as a guitar player,
Rick, are you any better now as a musician or a songwriter that you're sober?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think I was always a good guitar player, but I think I'm like really top of my game right now. And as a writer, I mean, you could think clearer. There's always that argument, well, you know, this one wrote this song when he was high, and the Beatles wrote these songs, and the Stones wrote these songs. That's true. But that was also a time, you know, a moment in time. And a lot of those Stone songs they wrote, they were living together in a one flat, cold water flat, you know, in England. Mm-hmm. So the argument doesn't stand with me. I agree. A lot of songs were written when people were buzzed on whatever they were doing. But there's been amazing songs written with people that were completely sober as well. But if the answer to the question is, yeah, I feel that I'm a better songwriter, performer, guitar player, producer than I have ever been.
Do you remember the first time you went on stage?
You can hear it in my recordings, you know. What happened?
Do you remember the first time you went on stage sober? What kind of experience was that?
Yeah, I don't remember specifically that night, but I know something. There's a lot of people that have a lot of fear of that. I don't think I have fear. I mean, first of all, I'm a ham, so there's that. I like being in front of people and performing, and I just never had that fear.
Well, that's good.
Of getting up in front of people. Now, there's a different word, adrenaline. So I love and live for, which is also an addiction, I would assume. To this day, like if I'm performing somewhere, like 5-10 minutes before I go on, I start feeling a little nauseous, lightheaded. Mm-hmm. But it's adrenaline, and I love it, and I get off on it, and then I hit the stage, and I'm fine because I've been doing it for so long.
Yeah,
you know, so
yeah.
You know that takes over, and there's no problems. But I do like that feeling of. I can't do this.
Who were your influences growing up musically?
The same as everybody, pretty much. That is my demographic. I grew up on the Beatles and the Stones and Hendrix and the Kinks and Smokey Robinson and Sam Cooke and B.B. King and Albert King and, you know, Howlin' Wolf. There's a deep pool that a lot of us that are this demographic came from and pulled from. Guitar playing, Jeff Beck, number one,
really?
Top of the list.
Jeff Beck.
Yeah, I mean, there's about four or five guitar players that I obviously, if you listen to my playing, you'll hear a little bit. And I'm not, you know, the only one. It's rare to hear Lady Jeff Beck. It's hard to find somebody that plays like Jeff Beck because he was completely from another planet. So, lead guitar and thought process, Jeff Beck, vibe, rhythm, swagger, Keith Richards. And songwriting, obviously. And then there's a bunch of other guys. Paul Kossoff from Free, I loved. Clapton back when he played with the Blues Breakers and Cream. Jimmy Page, of course. I mean, I was a little kid. I was looking at these people. They were like these monsters. They were bigger than life, right?
You know, I remember an interview that I saw that somebody asked John Lennon, is Ringo the greatest drummer in the world? And John Lennon replied, he's not even the best drummer in this band.
Oh, wow.
Did you ever hear that? Did you ever see that one?
No.
That was great. All right, so, okay. Let me see where we are right now. All right, so you're...
But John Lennon was a wise ass.
Well, yeah. You never met him, did you?
No. But he was, you know, he had that kind of personality, which was fabulous.
Yeah.
You know. And then they, you know, they took the piss out of each other. And at some point, they didn't get along with each other.
Well, you're with somebody long enough, you know, even in marriage.
Yeah, the Stones. What about that, you know, anybody that remembers the 80s Keith and Mick fight that went on?
I remember.
Where they weren't even talking to each other.
Yeah, I remember it. Hey, if you're just joining us now, we're talking with Ricky Bird, 10 years with Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, and with a laundry list, I might say, of very, very accomplished musicians. And Ricky is too.
I hope I didn't besmirch anybody.
No, we're not going to besmirch.
Ricky, I got a question for you, which I've always wondered. What was Joan Jett like? I remember in the 80s watching on MTV and seeing her and all this and seeing you guys, which was awesome. But what was her personality like? What was it like playing with Joan Jett?
She's definitely a tough person, but she's a doll, and we never had a cross word. I mean, maybe, you know, over something stupid, but I don't remember ever having a real argument with her. And we were together for, you know, 10 years. We were like brother and sister in that band, right? I mean, I stood next to her shoulder to shoulder on stage every night, around the world a few times. So she's great. You know, I don't know what else to say about her.
You know, she was born she's a
rock and roll icon,
right?
No? You know, she's a rock and roll icon.
She was born near,
I mean,
near.
She had to put up with a lot of nonsense about being a guitar player and a girl. You know, people wouldn't just say she was a great. She's great for a girl. You know, she's cool as a person. You know,
I was just saying that we're outside of Philadelphia right now.
I know that.
And she was born 10 minutes from here at Lankin Hill Hospital.
Wow. How'd you know that, Gary?
As my wife says, I have a lot of useless information in my head. Okay?
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Well, now you know I was born at Bronx Hospital.
Now I know you were born in Bronx Hospital.
Yep.
And you're a baseball fan, aren't you, Ricky?
You could say that.
Yankees. He's a Yankee, big time Yankees fan, right?
Yeah, next Thursday. I'm just sitting here waiting. I'm trying to finish Godfather of Harlem. I'm on season 3. So next Thursday I go back into the Yankee baseball every day watching on TV pool.
Wow.
It's so cool to think that, like, right now you're sitting in your studio, and I guess you have, like, you know, guitars around and all that, and you're just taking a break to talk to us on a Friday afternoon, Ricky.
Well, there's also the washing machines to my left, because my studio's in my basement.
Washing to the left.
But yeah, if I'm looking to my right, I see. I went out and I got like these two giant Home Depot racks, and I got my guitars lined up, acoustics and electrics, and I got the amps on the bottom shelf. Little amps. I mean, I don't have as many guitars as you would think at this point. I've come kind of narrowed down. I mean, there's plenty up there, but it's not like some people. I mean, maybe I got 20 guitars or something. I don't know.
Let me ask you something. Who would you like to meet, an artist, right now that you've never had access to? Who would give you a thrill? Like, so many people, if they could meet you, would be thrilled.
I'm going to say I've met Keith Richards a couple of times, but I would love to have, like, lunch with the guy.
Yeah, you know, how he's still alive.
I'd like to play with him, sure. But I'd like to meet Rod Stewart. You know, Rod Stewart was a huge, I loved, well, visually, of course, the faces, that whole look.
Yeah.
When I was a teenager, you know, I adopted. And my hair is still standing up. It's white, but it's standing up.
It looks good, Ricky. You know that?
Well, thank you. Yeah. But I would love to play Maggie May with him just once before this game is over. Mm-hmm.
And I
just
know
because it was such a big, it was a big song when I was a little kid, you know, and it was just part of my, the sewn together blanket of all the stuff I listened to.
Maggie May was 1971.
Tapestry was the word I was looking for.
Carole King.
Yeah, I was talking about the tapestry of all the music.
Yeah, I know that. I know that. I know that. I know that. Hey, listen, we got to take a break. Ricky, can you hang with us a couple more minutes? Come on.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break, and give us a call, 1-888-728-9941. Get your opportunity to talk to a rock and roller. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Diversity in the workplace is more than gender, ethnicity, and even age. It also means people in recovery. The Higher Calling Foundation works to end the stigma of substance use disorders in the workplace by helping those in recovery find jobs, get career counseling, and more. All things insurance doesn't cover, and all at no cost. and encouraging businesses to hire employees in recovery. Because with the Great Resignation, there are jobs to be filled, and employees in recovery are an untapped demographic. It's mutually beneficial, and it's simply good business. Started by employment attorney in recovery Kevin Heyer, the Heyer Calling Foundation believes everyone deserves a second chance and works to make that happen. And now, diversity in the workplace demands it. Visit HeyerCalling.org. That's H-Y-E-R calling.org. And find out how we can help you.
Hi, I'm Tony Luke Jr., and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-728-9941. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Hey, we're back. I was just informed that we're back, Mark. You know that?
We're back.
I hope Ricky's,
we are back.
I hope Ricky's still on the other end.
With Ricky Bird of Joan Jett and the Blackhearts.
Formerly.
Still so cool.
Ricky Bird. Hey, Ricky, remember when you played my Stratocaster?
Oh, here we go.
I do.
Huh? And then when I got home, I plugged it in. It didn't sound anything like you.
Did you see his studio in his basement, Ricky?
How would he see the studio?
We won't even bring this up. I mean, he's got a great little studio.
Unfortunately, I can't play.
I've got a cool little Pro Tool studio here, but my co-producer that we do all my records, he comes over here, or he's got to come over here soon again. And I'm really behind the eight ball, and I know some, 14-year-olds know how to do Pro Tools. But I think it's a thing where I'm lazy. I don't want to do the stuff myself. Like, I would rather go someplace and record. But yeah. I have it. I'm looking right at it. I've got the whole thing set up. I should be able to just turn it on if I have an idea and just record little things. And I know it's easy because he keeps telling me. But I need one more lesson. He's going to come over here. Then, I just have to do it.
What, Ricky, what is new? Tell us what's going on. What do you have coming out? I know you mentioned.
Okay, well, first of all, let's talk about for a second, and I'll go on to what I have out.
Yeah.
I'm working as an ambassador for a new recovery platform called allsober.com. And you know that, Gary.
Right, we're on it.
Gary's on the inspiration page, and we're trying to get a Clean and Sober Radio page. But it's an informational site, and I agreed to work with them. I'm basically helping them get people for the inspiration page. Mm-hmm. And if you go on there, allsober.com, on the inspiration page, you'll see some people you've probably grown up listening to that are in recovery, recover out loud, and want to be a power of example. And I love the platform and what they're doing, because I do recover out loud. Over the years, I've had many, many people find me on social media and message me and say, I need help. Can you tell me where there's a treatment facility here or there? Or do you know what insurance they take? And I don't know any of that. I know people that know it. But here's the thing, here's a platform that's going to have everything in one-stop shopping, where you could find some place in your area and find out what kind of clientele it caters to, seniors, young, this and that. Alcohol and drugs. And then there's like aftercare, and there's like how to hook up with the sober community. And, I really believe that they're doing the right thing, which is why I'm doing it. And if anybody's listening, you should just go check it out. You never know when it might come in handy for you. It's a, it's a free app, and it's a pretty impressive site, platform. And I know it's just getting bigger and bigger, and a lot of people have been going, and they have a lot of views. And so I've been doing that. I've been, helping people in recovery, going to my meetings. What else? Doing events. I just did a recovery event in New York at City Winery with Roseanne Cash and Steve Earle. That was really cool. And
wow,
a bunch of
cool
other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was to raise money for the transgender LGBTQ community in recovery. And Rich Pagano, the guy who put it on, his son unfortunately passed away a few years ago. Mm-hmm. from I think it was fentanyl, if I'm not mistaken. But in any event. So I did that. I just did a gig, another gig at the winery. I love doing these gigs where I do one song. I just show up, my guitar, play, and then I go home.
And they pay you?
No, I didn't get paid for this. These are like, you know, recovery. These are local recovery events. But then the other thing is I signed a deal with Wicked Cool Records, Little Steven's label, for singles. I want to do singles. And guaranteed it's going to wind up an album at some point. But my planning was to just do singles. So we had I wrote a song in the middle of the pandemic when I was down here in my basement called Glamdemic Blues, big sort of glamish, because I listened to a lot of glam too when I was a teenager, like Slade and Sweet and stuff like that. It was the coolest song in the world on Little Steven's Underground Garage, February, I think it was the 27th. And they're playing the hell out of that. And I got another one coming out on April 21st called Alien, which was basically, I had a dream that I was having a mob sit down with a crew of aliens. Actually, Little Steven was in the dream. He was like the mediator, like sort of like on Silvio.
Really?
And I was trying to buy the human race some more time.
I was trying to buy
the human race some more time. That was what I was trying to do.
Rick,
we'll do better. We'll try and do better. So that's coming out April 21st. Another single. You could actually go to rickybird.com. If you don't have any of my records, I have two recovery CDs, rock and roll, straight up rock and roll, but all about recovery.
Mm-hmm. They're excellent, by the way.
Thank you. Clean Getaway and Sobering Times. You can buy them on my website. I put together like a spring bundle and throw a lot of extra jazz in there. And what else? You know, just seeing what's next.
All right. Okay. Listen, we're coming up on the hour. Rick, again, you know, thanks for being a friend of mine to the show. And I just really appreciate the friendship and the support you give us.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what. If this April 8th acoustic gig does well,
yeah.
In other words, like I remember the songs,
yeah,
and I have like a hot hour and 15 of stuff, then yeah. We could do another event.
Oh, that'd be awesome!
That'd be fabulous, man. That'd be great.
I gotta get used to doing it. I mean, that the 3 years that we spent not doing anything,
yeah.
Really got me lazy, where I got to like relearn this stuff again, you know.
Yeah,
it's a lot of stuff to remember, a lot of lyrics and this and that. And I'm looking forward to someday, I hope, getting a chance to be that recovery troubadour guy again, where I go to treatment facilities around country and do the songs that wound up on those two albums. And actually, that thing you played of the kids, you could hear them in the background.
Yeah,
we love that.
So that was, I was a keynote speaker, I think it was Tacoma, Washington. I was sort of outside of Seattle or something. And I went to a school, a high school, and I did a talk to them about recovery, and I played a couple of songs and stuff. And I think I was on the radio with
you?
Yes,
you were.
By coincidence?
Yeah.
Right. And I got them to do that. So
yeah,
it lives forever.
That was live. Lives forever.
We play that all the time.
Ricky, thank you so much, brother.
Thanks, Ricky.
Yeah,
we'll talk soon.
See you soon.
Yep. Play some tunes.
You got it. Thanks, buddy. Great guy.
Great guy. Yeah.
Great interview. How much time we got?
And okay. It's so cool. You know, here he is, Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, and he's sitting in his basement, you know, in his studio, his home studio, talking to us on Clean and all of our viewers and listeners on Clean and Sober Radio.
That's right. That's good stuff. I think we have time for one email that we received. We do? Okay. Mark C. from Key West, Florida. Do you consider somebody clean and sober if you use drugs like Percs and marijuana for medical reasons?
It's a controversial issue, you know, because you get some people – it really is case by case, because sometimes you have somebody that has cancer and is legitimately using it medicinally as prescribed – you know,
so it's all about being honest with yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's all about being it. But we get a ton of people, you know, where it's the opposite. They're really abusing it.
Of course. Absolutely. Let me give you one more. Jarrell C. from the Bronx. Tell me how I can tell my story on your show. I've been clean for 3 years. Well, Jarrell, go to our website, cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com, and leave us a message. Right?
And we'll get back to you.
And we'll get back. Okay, here we go. Remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, help is available. Please call 1-800-662-HELP. For Clean and Sober Radio, I'm Gary Hendler.
I'm Mark Sigmund.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about our broadcast, please join us on our mission at cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.